Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe. And we got an email addressed to us. Good morning, Gabe.
Just to you.
Well, you're at the end because it says, good morning, Gabe, and then there's an asterisk after my name. And then if you look down to the end of the email, and Connor too. But let me explain the reasoning here. It says, good morning, Gabe of the Mooing Cow, as if that's my name, because last week I did my cow moo,
mm-hmm.
heard around the world, resonated around the world.
It really was. It really was.
And this listener here said that it made him think about a tune that he remembers, a song. And it sprang to mind when I heard your provocative sounds.
Provocative.
And we're not going to play it now. It'll be, you know how we have music at the break? We always in the middle of our show, we have a little segment of music. That's just wait for it.
So we have more original music.
But we have another email about cows from Hazen.
Hazen sent this and was talking about Hazen's, their two cows.
Mm-hmm.
This in connection to the cow we talked about on the show last week, Veronica, up on a mountainside in southern Austria. And if you look online, you can see all sorts of videos of Veronica scratching her back, 13-year-old cow, using both ends of a push broom, effectively. And so this listener wanted to write in and add yet another cow to the list of cows that can manipulate tools in this sense. And in this case, it was two of them. And at one point, the owner of these cows found one of them, PJ was his name.
PJ.
Wandering around, loose, out of its pen or out of its little...
in the pasture somewhere, yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm just going to read from the email. Thinking that her door had been left open accidentally and with no harm done, I forgot about it until she was loose again the next day. So 2 days in a row, this cow's out.
Yeah. And then the farmer thinks, there's no way I forgot the door twice. So something's going on or what?
Right. They apparently had girls who were taking care of the cows. And so it says here, I chastised the girls who fed the evening meal.
Got you.
Be sure to close the door properly. Polite words were exchanged, and then they wondered, maybe the latch is defective. No. The next day, I decided to leave PJ in the box stall while I got the other one ready to train. PJ was normally readied first, and she became very attentive as I worked. I ignored her, and after a few minutes, she grasped the latch handle with her lips, slid it open, and quietly stood in the open doorway looking at me as if to say, what do you think of that?
Good cow.
Good cow. Cows are smart.
Cow.
Yeah, I think we tend to think of them as two-dimensional, cartoonish farm characters that exist somewhere to kind of give us sustenance. Mm. There's a lot we don't know about them, a lot to learn. They're smart.
Yeah. Should I get into mine first, or how are we doing this?
Let me start with a quick one here.
Yeah.
Very, very quick. It's a message for anyone in middle age, which in this study is defined as 31 to 46.
Okay.
We're in there, Gabe.
Yeah.
Sorry to break it to you.
I got no problems with that.
The message for everyone out there is that your stress will very likely be higher during that time period if you're not exercising. Now, that's kind of obvious, I think, to some people, maybe not to others. But if you feel stressed out or have an issue with stress, if it's affecting your life, your sleep, exercise appears to, at the very least, strongly correlate to decreasing stress. How do they know that?
How do the researchers find that out? Yeah.
It's called the 1966 Northern Finland Cohort. All of the people, more than 3,000, that they looked at for this longitudinal study were born in 1966.
Yeah.
And they had various things surveyed and done to them at different phases of their lives. And between 31 and 46, they were able to, based on WHO definitions, assess whether or not they were active and to what extent. So either they were stable inactive, they just never did much physically, or they were decreasing. So they had been kind of active, and from age 31 to 46, they went down.
Yeah.
Or they increased in that time.
Okay.
Or they were stable active and they kept doing it.
That's important. So you watch over time as they become more active or less active. If there's an effect.
Exactly. Okay, those two are really critical for what they did, which is to look at biological markers of stress. And there was a significant correlation between the people who remained active and lower levels of stress.
Got it.
Or increased their activities. If they decreased, the stress went up. If they remained inactive, the stress was high.
And stress was measured with cortisol, or how were they doing that?
Norepinephrine,
yep.
Yeah. Those, again, lots of different ways that they tested this, two different biological marker tests. But they were, yeah, physiologically objective, which is a nice way to understand what has happened to the human body over that time. So yeah, if you're stressed out, try to exercise more. It may help.
Looking into the phenomenon now of how you can, or how we can draw different conclusions when looking at the same thing. In public debate in the United States right now, this is happening. People watching the same video and drawing different conclusions about that video. This show is not about weighing in on political debates. You guys know that. That's not what we do. But what we try to do is provide scientific evidence that might explain phenomena that are happening right now. And this phenomenon of taking the same thing yet and how it can produce different conclusions about it stretches well beyond public debate. It stretches into the scientific community.
So the feeling some of you may have where it seems like other people online are just crazy. It's like, what are they watching?
Who is wrong?
Yeah.
I'm seeing something.
They're seeing something.
It's clear to me that it's this way, yet other people are saying the opposite?
And what's
going on?
Yeah, what is going on?
Well, this has been done. It's called the reproducibility crisis. So you take a scientific experiment happens, results are produced, and then somebody else tries to do the experiment with the same data, and different results are produced. Mm-hmm. This happens to scientists as well. These two researchers wanted to look into what's going on there. One of them is at the Kennedy School in Harvard, and the other is at the Leibniz Institute for Lifelong Learning here in Germany. So big time figures in the social sciences, one at Harvard, one at Leibniz. And they wanted to look into what's going on. How does this happen? And what they did was they tested 158 researchers, grouped them into teams, like-minded teams, and I'll explain why in a second. And they provided them the same exact data, asked them to use it to formulate conclusions. But and before they looked at the data, they were asked, does immigration lead to more acceptance in society for social welfare programs?
And that was the question that caused them to be attached to a certain group.
The results differed wildly.
So they have the same data.
They have the same exact social science data, these 73 teams. Some of them saw a strong link between immigration and acceptance of social welfare. Others saw no link at all. Others saw the exact opposite. So all three different things. And then the researchers wanted to look at why. And then they looked back at the way that these researchers answered that question. Does immigration have an effect on acceptance for social welfare? In 88% of the cases, the way they answered that question determined the results that they produced in their team.
Right. So this is the one part of the reproducibility crisis, right? The exact same data and various researchers who are at the top of their field possibly are...
They're scientists.
Yeah, they're...
And it appears that ideology sways them. Just like it seems that ideology sways the way that people are perceiving, the reason why debate is so divided right now in the United States seems like you're looking at the same thing and producing different conclusions about it. It doesn't only happen to you; it also happens to scientists.
And how interesting it must have been to be a scientist and a participant in a study. I mean, you know the tricks of the trade and what they're trying to get at. They probably had to double or triple trick them.
Oh yeah, big time. Yeah,
to get them
to arrive at that 88%. They went through all kinds of different ways to make sure, based on the statistical models used by each of those participants, that ideology was the reason for it. But in 88% of the cases, that was the reason why. So it's something to be aware. If you're faced with someone right now who has the diametric opposite conclusion based on when you're talking about the same thing, it seems to be a natural human phenomenon.
Even if you're trying to be the most objective scientific scientist.
That's the point.
It even affects them. An interesting way to understand why people end up with the biases they have or the prejudices.
Ideological bias.
I'll make this quick at the end here. I do think it's kind of fair to do this. We talked a while back about female breasts on this show, and that study was from Papua New Guinea.
Yeah.
And the question there that the researchers were asking is, there's this idea that if you put clothing on certain parts of the human body, it makes it more sexually attractive. And is that true for the human breast?
Yeah.
By putting, is it less sexually attractive in a tribe where everyone's nude than when you're kind of hiding it and just showing like hints of it? And in that study, which had its limitations, the answer was no. Putting clothes on that part of the female body do not change.
Do not make them more attractive.
Correct.
Breasts, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
So today we're going to switch over to the study out of Australia on the male penis. And okay. I'm just going to read straight from the top. It says, among primates, the human penis is an evolutionary outlier. Controlling for body size, the human penis has a greater girth and is generally longer than that of other primates. And the question is why?
Yeah.
Why would we have that?
Why?
Why
is that?
It's not necessary from a reproductive point of view. If you want to have more offspring or mate, it doesn't have to be. So what happened? So most of the studies part of this one looked at post-copulatory interpretations of the male penis, meaning the size and shape must have something to do with sperm success rates or mm-hmm. sperm survival or the removal of a rival male's sperm from the canal. And this one is relatively unique in that it's just looking at people standing there. How it looks?
Mm-hmm.
And is it determined by women or is it also determined by men? So I'm going to show you a picture, one of the many, many pictures that they showed participants in the study.
Oh.
And you can describe real quick for our listeners, give them an idea what they're looking at.
Yeah, we got human being A, B, and C, all differing heights and differing lengths as well, I guess.
Yeah. So
Boy, C's not pretty well.
Well endowed.
Doing well.
Yeah. So these are computer generated simulated men. They're not real men. And so they can tweak every aspect of them, including that part of the body, longer, shorter, but then other things as well. And for this study, they had 350 of those images and they were rated by 200 women. And the women were only looking at those images for sexual attractiveness. Mm-hmm. What do I find sexually attractive? That's it.
And who did they find attractive, A, B, or C here?
I'll get that there in a second. For the 600 men, which is interesting, 200 women, 600 men uh-huh. looking at these, they were looking for two things. What do I think women would find attractive? And that question, the question they asked specifically was, how jealous would you feel if this guy talked to your girl? That was the question.
Got it.
And the other thing that was unusual is, how do you think he'd be if you had to fight him? As a rival, as a physical rival,
based on the height or the length did it not matter?
Yeah, and so obviously height was gonna. If you're gonna think about whether or not you're gonna be successful fighting this guy, height is a big factor. Also, what they call the V shape, so the ratio of how broad the shoulders are down to the hip,
muscle bound. Yeah,
women found that very attractive. That was the most important criteria for them. That V shape more okay. important than height, more important than penis length. For
really?
Men, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
For men. Although penis length does play a role. That is part of the reason it is larger. When you have primates that stand up and you can see it for hundreds of thousands of years,
yeah.
that played a role. The same thing with breast shape and size. You have to acknowledge that part. But males also look at this and judge things. Men are good at judging what women would find attractive in these guys, mm-hmm. which includes penis length. The other thing is when it comes to fighting, obviously broad shoulders, height, but the size of the rival's penis was a factor. If it was larger, men tended to think that guy could possibly beat me in a fight. Hence, and now we're getting into the realm of speculation, the idea that there is evolutionary pressure for a larger penis because it's less likely that the rival would attack or want to fight him because he sees this larger penis and decides he doesn't.
Got it.
Now, I heard a lot of discussions. There were a lot of comments online saying, I don't understand this at all. Because actually, that would be a disadvantage to have this thing flopping around while you're trying to fight some
guy. It's more weight that you're carrying around, right? In the end.
And it might get injured as part of the process. But I thought it was actually somewhat compelling what the authors suggested down right at the end of the paper, where they're saying, no, this does make sense because there's a correlation between the size of that part of the male body and testosterone.
Yeah,
which could connect to really muscle mass and the ability of that rival to fight you and take you down ultimately.
So not sperm quality, just how strong that person is.
How strong.
Is.
And yeah. the other part, and I know you know this is true.
Uh-huh.
As someone, you play on a hockey team, I play on a soccer team here in Germany. And afterwards we hit the showers. It's a fact that after intense physical activity, That part of your body retracts just as if you'd hopped in a cold swimming pool, right? And so I think a lot of...
It shrivels up is what you're trying
to
say.
And a lot of guys are kind of aware of that and sort of insecure about it as they hop into the showers right afterwards, right? Like this is... that's just a fact, even in middle-aged males. And the reason I mention that here is because if you're about to square off against a male rival, it's going to get physical, and it hasn't shrunken back, it would suggest this guy's relaxed. He's been here before, right? Or this is not necessarily for him. Do you see what I'm saying? It's not a fight or flight.
The fight or flight hasn't been activated here. He's not worried.
Yeah, this guy's been in a lot of fights.
He ain't nervous.
Yeah, I bet our listeners have something to say on that.
Yeah. What is the title of that study? So in case people want to jump in there and check that one out. Mine was Ideological Bias. In the production of research findings, what was yours?
Experimental evidence that penis size, height, and body shape influence assessment of male sexual attractiveness and fighting ability in humans, and that was in PLOS Biology.
It's so interesting.
It is really genuinely interesting to think about. Also the future, that now that we've covered ourselves with all these clothes, that's not going to play the same kind of role, right, as it did when 50,000 years ago we were walking around upright without much clothing on, depending on where you were.
I promised you guys a song at the beginning of the show today. This one here is from Corb Lund, performing with the Hurtin' Albertans at the Red Ants Pants Music Festival back in 2013.
About cows.
The song is called Cows Around, and this is Elton Lee's Ranch back at the Back Pasture Sessions back in 2013.
Well, there's Herford, Highland, Simmental, West Black, and Maine, and Jew, Key and Neme, and Limousine, Shorthorn, Soleil, what Tuesday, too, Texas, Longhorn, Corrie, Romagnola, Galloway, and Angus, Bramba, Brangus, Jersey, Guernsey, Holstein, hey!
And that's Corb Lund. Singing about cows, all kinds of different kinds of cows.
Well, I mentioned Veronica, the Austrian cow, earlier, but we've also talked about cow milking machines. We've talked about cows a lot recently. We'll leave it there for now. Enough about cows.
No, we're going to head to a supermarket. Or what kind of looks like a supermarket.
If you have ever gone shopping, grocery shopping, and then you look in your cart or your bags when you get them home, and you're like, why did I buy so much stuff and it's junk food and what am I doing? And I wish there was someone out there really truly researching how to make that shopping experience better for me in the sense of healthier and to make my life better. Gabe and I found him, and his name is Dominic Lemke, and he's at the University of Bonn.
Yeah, that's right. We went to visit him at his laboratory supermarket.
Science Unscripted.
This is like a convenience store, like a gas station-sized supermarket here, I would say?
It's a laboratory supermarket, right? It's a place that actually looks pretty much like a normal supermarket, and where people can imagine they're doing their shopping routine, and therefore we can actually track their shopping routine here. We can analyze it, we can start changing things in the setup and see how that changes the behavior.
How many people have come through these aisles so far in your experiment?
This week we are concluding the first experiment, so that's about 100 participants. It's a test that we have here. So usually you think about 200, 300 participants per experiment.
All right, what have you learned about where they stop and why they stop, or what are your results so far?
What we tested in the first experiment here was this kind of shelves, which is called a recipe assortment. Instead of having products by category, we sort them by recipe. So here you have a wet lentil bolognese as a recipe, and everything you need for that recipe is on one shelf.
Okay. You're drawing them in with this image of delicious-looking bolognese that's based on red lentils, and then you put every ingredient right there for them.
Yeah, exactly. It's trying to market healthy meals. And you can see some, of course, that's fully ignored and don't even have not – it hasn't even grabbed their attention. But you can see, like, just for 10 or 15% or so that say, okay, I don't have to make up my mind. I enjoy it. I just take it.
I've also noticed you've put the Nutella which is a wonderful little breakfast sin that Germans engage in all the time. I do too. You've hidden it, kind of, down on the shelf, I think.
People with back problems are having a tough time getting the Nutella.
Yeah, that's not on purpose, I have to admit.
Oh, okay.
Because this setup here is supposed to be as normal and standardized. You can see, for example, the prices, there's no special offers whatsoever. The prices are directly how we get them from the retail when we buy products from them that we sell here. So these are all stuff that we try to keep constant or just realistic, I would say.
And you give participants cash? I don't know, 50 euros, 100 euros? Or do they have to spend their own money here?
No, they're not allowed to spend their own money here. So they get 20 euros for participation, and this is the money they can spend within the store. And that is also the reimbursement or the endowment they get for actually doing the survey afterwards.
Germany is kind of famous for its supermarkets. They've spread beyond Germany. A lot of people outside this country know Aldi or Lidl or Trader Joe's. Germany's good at doing supermarkets, and I would guess they wouldn't want to listen to you. I guess that's kind of the issue, or the question I have is, let's say you figure out better, healthier ways for human beings to interact with the supermarket and eat, but these supermarkets don't make as much money as a result. They're not going to want to take your advice on. So who can you communicate this to affect change?
For once, I think there can be win-win situations. There can be situations in which, like, a single banana is also not sold well at the supermarket and often has to go to the rubbish. And this could be a way to think about selling more bananas, right? So this doesn't have to be in a conflict. And then there, of course, is always that some stuff is also relevant for policy. We can always think about policies on how to think about marketing, how to think about environmental cues. Like I said, in the UK, they got rid of this checkout stuff at the counter because they said, we don't want tobacco there, we don't want alcohol there, we don't want highly addictive goods there. And this is also something that can come out from such studies, but of course we need the evidence.
It's about, forcing people to eat healthier or psychologically helping them to realize that they should be eating healthier? Or what exactly is the point of this lab, this simulated supermarket here?
We would not call it forcing, right? We would call it making it easier. Nudging, it's called sometimes. That's one umbrella word that you can use, where you really don't tell people what to do, but you make certain decisions easier for them to choose. That can be by just changing the setup. You make it easier for them to choose water instead of the lemonade or whatever. And of course, they won't always decide for the water, but in some more cases, they will. That's what we know marketing works.
For our listeners all around the world, in a lot of different countries, different supermarkets, who don't have access to Dominic's version of the best kind of supermarket yet, obviously, none of us do, what can they do in a regular supermarket to eat healthier, to avoid making those impulse purchases and falling into the trap that the supermarkets set up for us?
It's not easy, right? It's a shopping training, basically. You can actually book that with nutritionists going through the supermarket and having a training session there. Yeah, the German Nutrition Society, for example, they have rules of thumb about the good outcomes of nutrition, right? Which is like 2 liters of water per day that you should drink, meat only once a week, fruits and vegetables, like you should have at least, I don't remember by heart, but I think it's 15 different fruits and vegetables that you should eat during a week.
But how do I do that? Or how do people walk into the supermarket? Should I have recipes printed? Should I'm as foolish, I mean this, as everyone else out there. I don't know what I'm doing in that supermarket, and I get sucked in. A frozen pizza, yeah, I'll take a frozen pizza. Probably not the best thing. What does an expert, a supermarket expert, have to tell the world about what we can do better or how to avoid getting tricked inside a supermarket?
The key we have to understand is that we are influenced by our environment, right? So sometimes it's not that easy. And for different environments, you need different strategies. So it's not like you have a one-fits-all approach here. But of course, you can do stuff like you already suggested, that stuff that, like, don't go on an empty stomach. You will overbuy. Try to plan your shopping. What do you really need? What is impulse? then we think your habits, because even sometimes you buy habitual products that you always buy, that stuff that you need to rethink, do they fit to dietary guidelines? And there's also this kind of thing that you should always start with the healthy products, first have that in the shopping cart, and then allow you a little bit of indulgence, right?
Dominic, I'm going to spend my own money. Can you give me a personal session? Because I am a very impulsive buyer, just an impulsive person. Can you take me through these aisles and we go shopping? I'll spend my own money, and then afterwards I'll tell our listeners what I bought. Would you do that for me?
I don't think so. No.
Oh, come on.
No. I have to start with the inventory system and have to start up the computer. I'm not really willing to do that.
This is probably neither here nor there for most of my listeners, but one thing that still shocks me here in Germany, and I've been here forever at this point, is going through the supermarket and getting to the conveyor belt, and you've got those impulse purchases, chewing gum, candy bars, and then you've got little bottles of grain liquor, just in case you forgot that you wanted to get exceptionally drunk today as an impulse purchase. Do you think that should stay or do you think that should go?
It should go. That's exactly the point of it.
Germans have the reputation for being a healthy people. Is that untrue? Are Germans unhealthy, Dominic?
I think that Germany has a long tradition of making nutritional questions more of a family thing than a policy thing. That's why we don't have a good or a long tradition of any nutritional policy. That's a key thing. That's why often you see in terms of like purchases of highly processed foods and stuff like that, we are maybe behind the UK, the second biggest buyer of highly processed food. It's much better in this Southern Europe, for example, right? Still better than the US for sure, but we are up there.
And that was Dominic Lemke giving us a tour of his third floor. You're way up in the back of an office building, a newly renovated, great carpet, great white paint all over the walls. And then you walk through a door that feels like you'd be going into somebody's office where they'd be typing on a computer. No, it's a 55 square meter, roughly 600 foot supermarket.
Yeah, and Dominic was giving us a sense of how to nudge people in the direction of healthier, choosing healthier products. But and what we were talking about when we turned the mics off, I found it really interesting about how the private companies out there, I mean, this is a generalizing statement, but he said this is what they do. They're looking to maximize positive vibes. They're not necessarily interested in maximizing the healthy selection.
Yeah, which is different. The vibes part was, especially at the end of the shopping experience, if the last thing you experience is really positive, you're like, yeah, I feel great, you're going to want to go back. And so what I took from his messaging there afterwards was maybe we should try to pay attention to the little supermarkets that don't leave us with that feeling. They can be a little dirty, dusty, not set up properly. But if the fruit and the vegetables are set up, you know, closer to the door or closer to where I will actually grab them, and they're not trying to, fill your cart with extra things that you don't need, that slightly more negative experience is actually better, or could be better.
Could be better. It may be. What do you guys think out there? For the healthy eaters, when you're in the supermarket, how do you do it? How do you not choose the crap, the stuff that's not good for you?
That's the biggest question. Let us know. We need your help.
I certainly do.
The world needs your help. We are su@dw.com.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.